I continue to be mystified by the reaction of folks such as yourself to the, what do we call it, retirement, I guess, of Senator Jeff Flake in Arizona. There are certain things that happen that, you know, there have been a variety of occurrences in the time that I've been alive where I felt like an alien from another planet. Like I was sent here to observe the behavior of these weird creatures that I do not understand. You know, every once in a while something happens and everybody reacts one way, and I'm standing over here by myself reacting completely different and wondering what's going on here? What's the logic? And this is one of those moments. On social media, I'm seeing tweets and Facebook posts and diatribes and expressions along the lines of, this is the gist of it, good riddance, Jeff Flake was horrible, he was the establishment, he was the swamp, this is the swamp draining itself, MAGA, 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 hail a new day, right? But when I press people, and it's, I'm not trying to be antagonistic, I just ask a simple question, which is, what has Jeff Flake done? What has he said or voted on? Very specifically, what has he voted on? What has he done in his capacity in the Senate that is definitive of this swamp you speak of? What has he done in the Senate that is definitive of this establishment you cite?
Well, he did vote for the bill that just passed that said you can't sue banks.
Okay.
And that's pretty swampish.
All right.
But that's the most recent example I can think of.
Well, and that's one thing that I'm sure if you took a look at the roll call, there'd be all sorts of people on there from a variety of broader ideological stripes who voted for both for and against. Like if you're gonna, in other words, I guess my question is, what's the threshold? Like, at what point does somebody become a swamp creature?
Sure, I don't know. I think that, like, Flake is just as deserving of praise and condemnation as the rest of them, so sure. I don't care.
Well, okay, I grant you. Maybe I don't grant you. I don't know. It's because here's the thing. I don't understand what it is that the party and the movement, because obviously the movement has gone in a different direction from where I ever was, right? Like, I don't understand what it's fighting for anymore. What are the set of policy goals? What's the overall ideology? What does government look like? Where are we heading toward? That's what I don't understand. And I'm in next hour, you know, I'm spending far more time on this than I intended to this segment. I meant this to be a tease for next hour, but you know, it's what's on my mind. So what can I do? But tell me what the destination is, because that's the thing. When I was in the Tea Party and when we were fighting back against the Obama administration and against the establishment as we saw it at that time, I could articulate for you what the goal was, what the destination was, what it was that we were trying to achieve. We were trying to restore the republic as defined in law by the Constitution and as defined in spirit by the Declaration of Independence. We were trying to effect a government that was going to secure the condition of liberty so that people could pursue their own happiness and their own values as they defined them, absent the force of their fellow human beings. And then, you know, you could apply that idea to specific policies and specific legal prescriptions that you could then try to achieve, you could try to enact, you could incorporate into platforms and try to get people elected, try to secure majorities so that you could pursue these goals. There was a destination and there was a path leading to that destination. I don't see that from the Trump movement. I don't see an end goal that's defined in an articulate way that where there's a path, where there's a step 1, 2, 3, 4, and then eventually you get to the destination and we all get to celebrate and put on our MAGA hats.
The step is loyalty to Trump. That's the goal.
Well, I would tend to agree with you. Is that wrong? 651-989-5855. Is the goal of this something other than just being the person who gets crowned most loyal, biggest fan, president of the fan club of Donald Trump. Is there a better goal than that, or any goal other than that? Closing argument, by the way, is the name of our show. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Again, the number 651-989-5855. That's Brad Omlin producing the show, taking your calls. Like I say, I didn't plan for the show to start off on this foot. We're going to get more into, you know, an analysis of what Steve Bannon in particular is doing right now, which echoes some of the missteps that the Tea Party made a couple of years back, and indicates to me that this movement that everybody's excited about right now is ultimately going to end up going nowhere. We'll get into that next hour, maybe a little bit this hour, depending upon where your calls take us. For the time being, I want to turn to a topic that's much more unifying for this audience and myself, and that is to just hang our heads and shake our heads and marvel at the extraordinary level of corruption that is now being revealed from the former Obama administration and the Clinton campaign. It's unbelievable. And the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. At this point, it's becoming a snowball where each day a new revelation compounds what it is that we learned the day before. Before we get into that, we'll go ahead and take Sue's call in St. Paul on the question of what is the goal of the Trump movement. How you doing, Sue?
Hi. I'm actually a never-Trumper, just like you were, but now it's a moot point because he's in.
Yeah, right.
And I don't like the way he talks either. I never did. That's why one of the main reasons why I was a never-Trumper. He didn't sound quite with it to me, you know. But now that he's in, the goal is to, when he, for me, it's to get, when he does something good, to get it done, you know. But the goal, I decided a couple days after I came out of my shock, I thought sure that Cruz was going to get it, that I was rooting for.
Mm-hmm.
But a few days after, I was magically thinking maybe Cruz could run as a write-in. I'll write him in.
Oh, you're talking about once the nomination was secure?
Yeah. But then when I came to my senses and I knew that wasn't going to happen,
mm-hmm.
it was going to be Trump or Hillary. Well, mm-hmm. there was no doubt in my mind then. And my rationale for that was that Hillary will get everything she wants.
Mm.
And with the opposition Trump had,
mm-hmm.
including the Republicans, he's going to have an uphill battle, at least, if he does something really crazy.
So you actually banked on a kind of a stalemate, which we've actually seen manifest since the election.
Well, I didn't bank on that much of a stalemate. I thought when he did something good,
sure.
the Republicans would go along with it.
Right.
But they're just backstabbing him, that's all, I think. You know?
Interesting.
But, and I do
so it goes back to this loyalty question of, you know, personal loyalty?
No, I cringe every time he opens his mouth, you know, unless he's reading from a prepared speech, I'm okay with it, you know, but I generally cringe. But, you know, that's not the main thing. You know, his braggadocio and the way he talks, I don't think he's as dumb as he sounds. I mean, but, I have a problem talking to myself, so I can identify with that. I think he has problems with getting the words he wants. I mean,
well,
he
sure,
repeats them
sure.
over and over and over again. It's fabulous.
But look, here's the thing. All of those personal foibles,
yeah.
you know, as much as they annoyed me as well during the campaign and have since the election, I can forgive all of that, right? I can forgive the gaffes. I can forgive the misstatements. I can forgive his personal conduct that really has nothing to do with how he serves in the role of President of the United States. I can forgive all of the above if, and this is an important if, there is a policy goal that is being advanced and that I can see, I can understand the strategy in place to achieve it. And that is the missing piece. in my analysis. And, you know, and maybe I'm just too, there's something about this whole political game that escapes me. Maybe I'm standing too close to something, or maybe I'm not close enough to understand what the missing piece is that is the point above and beyond policy. Because to my mind, that's the whole point of all of this. Like, why should I go to caucus? Why should I show up for a primary? Why should I show up on election day? Why should I spend any time or expend any thought or energy in political endeavors whatsoever if the goal is not to actually change the law to affect a condition of governance that betters my life?
Yeah.
And I don't see the plan for that.
No, I think he leans too Democrat. I don't understand why he doesn't get the fact that the Democrats are out to destroy him. Isn't he waking up yet? You know, he keeps saying we want to, you know, have bipartisan vote, you know. Well, it's not going to happen with the Democrats. It's not.
Sure.
Why doesn't he realize that? Why did he keep that Rosen guy in under Sessions? I mean, that was insane, you know. Why isn't he getting rid of those? Yeah, he just, yeah, it frustrates me too. You don't know where he's going. But all the Republicans are frustrating, you know.
Sure. I appreciate your call, Sue, and appreciate the insights. I don't think I'm any closer to understanding this, though.
Nope.
I don't think I'm any closer to understanding it. So, anyway, we'll come back to it next hour. We got some things to consider regarding Steve Bannon's political activities and how it is an echo of where the Tea Party ended up, which, you know, I hate to say it, is pretty much nowhere, right? Like, there were some victories, right? There were 2010 was huge for the Tea Party. There was this Tea Party wave, as it was referred to, which still echoes down to this day. Like, one of the stories we covered recently was speculation regarding Kurt Dowd, Speaker of the House here in the Minnesota legislature, who is heavily rumored to be a gubernatorial candidate, unannounced, right? And one of the feathers in his cap that's cited as rationalization or justification for why he ought to run is that he's a winner, right? He's somebody who helped the House obtain its majority and expand its majority and what have you. Well, look, I don't deny or take away from at all the role that he played in those victories. But let's zoom out and take a look at the full picture, right? There was a wave happening. There was momentum taking place. He surfed on that wave of anti-incumbency. And it was defined at first in 2010 by the Tea Party. And the wind was at his back. But he did not control the wind, right? And to a large extent, I feel as though, and we'll get into it, you know, later in the show, I feel as though there is a similar phenomenon happening now where the wind is at the back of Trumpism, right? The wind is at the back of Make America Great Again. And so you see a lot of people who, you know, a lot of whom were openly horrified by Trump last year, openly horrified by him in the primary, who have suddenly adopted his characteristics, his demeanor, his rhetoric, and some of his policy positions because they see a winner. They see winning happening, right? And Steve Bannon, of course, is kind of a chief architect of all that, and he's doubling down on it for next year, and it's going to be interesting to see what ends up happening as a result. Didn't even get into this whole Clinton stuff. We will after the break. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. There are many aspects to what makes the news fake, right? Like, there's the choice of what they cover. There's the choice of what they don't cover. And then there's the particular way in which they cover the things that they do. And it's that last aspect of fakery that I'd like to explore here on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. If you want to join the program as we go along here tonight. From the Star Tribune. President Donald Trump and fellow Republicans latched onto revelations tying Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign to a dossier of allegations about his ties to Russia. The president said Wednesday it was a disgrace that Democrats had helped pay for research that produced the document. It just really, it's a very sad commentary on politics in this country, Trump said in addressing reporters one day after news reports revealed that the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee for several months last year helped fund research that ultimately ended up in the dossier. The document, compiled by a former British spy and alleging a compromised relationship between Trump and the Kremlin, has emerged this year as a political flashpoint. Law enforcement officials have worked to corroborate its claims. James Comey, FBI director at the time, advised Trump about the existence of the allegations. And the ex-spy who helped assemble the document, Christopher Steele, has been questioned as part of an ongoing probe into possible coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign. Trump has derided the document as phony stuff and fake news and portrayed himself Wednesday as an aggrieved party, posting on Twitter a quote he said was from Fox News that referred to him as the victim. The new disclosure about the dossier's origins is likely to fuel complaints by Trump and his supporters that the document is merely a collection of salacious and uncorroborated claims. Now, let's pause to reflect upon how this is being reported, right? Because, again, there are different ways in which the news manifests its fakery, okay? What they choose to cover, what they choose not to cover, and then how they cover the things that they do. And this is an example of how they cover the things that they do. This last paragraph that I shared with you here from the Star Tribune. Trump has derided the document, that is the dossier that was produced, funded by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, obviously as a political ploy, right? They were trying to conjure salacious information in order to influence the election. They were trying to create this Russian collusion narrative. Like, that's not in dispute. It's obvious, right? It's right in front of our face. It's objective. That document Trump has referred to today as phony stuff and fake news and portrayed himself as an aggrieved party. And then the last sentence they have here is that the new disclosure about the dossier's origins, which again is the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, is likely to fuel complaints by Trump and his supporters that the document is merely a collection of salacious and uncorroborated claims. So the source of the claim is Trump and his supporters. How about, as a journalist, you just simply acknowledge that that's true? Like, the evidence is clear that the collection is both salacious and uncorroborated. That is factually correct. If these claims in this dossier could be corroborated, we would be hearing about it nonstop, right? For months, they were trying to corroborate it. This is all part of the crafting, the manufacture of the Trump-Russia collusion narrative that's been ongoing since the election and was plotted, obviously, prior to the election. That's the implication of this story. That's the revelation of this story. That narrative was all along, that was their plan B. That was their go-to in the event that somehow, in the unlikely event that they somehow lost the election, their go-to was undermine the legitimacy of the president, undermine the legitimacy of the election by claiming that Russians interfered with it. An idea, as it turns out, that they got from their own experience colluding with Russians in order to affect political outcomes. In their case, involving nuclear deals, uranium one, right? And this is how the Star Tribune chooses to report it. Yeah, and you know, they wonder. They wring their hands and they scratch their heads and they wonder, why are people buying into this fake news meme? Well, it's because it's true. It's true.
Or just better yet, why aren't people reading our newspaper?
Yeah, right.
But I did look at some of it could be quotes, but I did do a quick spell check on it here and enabled the checking of passive sentences. Mm-hmm. And an easy way to tell when a person, like, inserts their opinion, like, right, modifies the way the sentence is written to insert themselves in it is, right, when it's written in passive voice. And generally in good writing, you only want, like, 10 to 15%. This article has 30%. I'm not saying, like, that's, oh, magic, you know, fake news, yeah, but, like, it's kind of a good indicator that something's up.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, what they hide behind is there's this sense of objectivity that has developed over the years in so-called journalism, whereby you're not supposed to you're not supposed to take sides. You're not supposed to actually conclude who's right and who's wrong. You're just supposed to report everything as so-and-so claims X and their opponent claims Y, right? And we're just standing here in between as impartial arbiters of what's true and what's false. Or not even that, not even because they're not trying. They claim that they're not trying to be the arbiter. They're just trying to present it to you. And yet, when you read stories that were pointing in the other direction, which we have numerous examples of going back to the election, any suggestion that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians was presented as unmitigated fact, as established. In recent days, in the aftermath of this controversy that's been, you know, kept up in the air like a hacky sack involving Trump and the widow of a fallen soldier and a congresswoman in Florida, reported in news articles as fact have been descriptions of what Trump said as patently offensive, inappropriate, you know, whatever negative connotation you want to apply to it. And that's in a news article. That's not an editorial. They present as news that it was inappropriate, that it was uncouth, you know, and that's okay. And then they try to pretend that they're somehow objective.
And guess what? You take out the quotes in the article and the passive sentences go up to 32%.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, well, there you go. Like Brad says, not a magic formula for determining fake news, but come on, guys.
And it's not that, like, this issue doesn't require explaining, because I think it does, but you can tell in the way that, like, it's not portrayed in an active voice. You know, mm-hmm. like, that's hard. I guess I'm having trouble explaining that, but, like, it shouldn't require you to insert yourself.
Right.
The facts should speak for themselves.
Well, and that's just it, is they're trying to blunt the impact of the facts, because the facts are inconvenient to their preferred political and cultural narrative and inconvenient to their allies, their political allies and the Democratic Party. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I said either yesterday or a couple of days ago that something was deeply wrong if these revelations regarding the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee didn't result in some sort of government action, some sort of complaints or lawsuits or congressional investigations or whatever the case may be. Looks like that stuff is starting to happen, which is appropriate. It should happen, right? It's entirely proper that that take place. It is interesting, though, at least this one aspect of it, this one manifestation of it that we're about to discuss, how it reveals kind of a systemic problem with our election system and our politics here in the United States of America that results in, look, you want to talk about draining the swamp. You want to talk about the establishment and getting rid of it and affecting real change. There's a systemic issue that needs to be addressed in order to accomplish that. And we're going to get into it here on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. Brad Ullman producing the show, taking your calls. This is Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can stream us at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. You can also catch up on the podcasts of past programs by searching for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app and go straight to our channel. From the Washington Times, Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democratic National Committee violated campaign finance law by failing to disclose payments for a dossier on Donald Trump, according to a complaint filed Wednesday with the Federal Election Commission. The complaint from the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center said the Democrats effectively hid the payments from public scrutiny, contrary to the requirements of federal law. By law, campaign and party committees must disclose the reason money is spent and its recipient. By filing misleading reports, the DNC and Clinton campaign undermined the vital public information role of campaign disclosures, said Adiv Noti, senior director of trial litigation and strategy at the Campaign for Legal or the Campaign Legal Center and a former FEC official himself. Voters need campaign disclosure laws to be enforced so they can hold candidates accountable for how they raise and spend money. The FEC must investigate this apparent violation and take appropriate action, he said. Now, on its face, this is great, right? Like, there should be this complaint. It should be acted upon. We should investigate. But I'm more interested, for at least for the sake of this discussion here on this program, I'm more interested in the overriding premise here and the systemic structure that's being appealed to, that being campaign finance law, the FEC, the idea that you and I, through some moral argument, some moral claim, have a right to know how much money people spend, to whom, on what terms, and for what purpose, right? Now, we can have that argument as to whether or not campaign finance law is morally justified. There's a lot to go into there, and it's an interesting argument. But for the time being, for the purposes of this story, what I want to highlight is that regardless of how you rationalize campaign finance law, unquestionably, the effect of it is to facilitate exactly what the Clinton campaign did and to facilitate exactly what the Democratic National Committee did. Campaign finance law is designed to keep normal people out. It's designed to keep you and I and people who have normal lives and normal concerns and go about our daily business out of the realm of politics. It's designed to erect a kind of a maze that you have to hire professionals to navigate for you. And if you can't afford to do that, or if you're somehow ignorant of how the maze is structured, you're going to fall into a legal trap and end up excluded from the process, excluded from the system. Now, the Clintons and the Democratic National Committee have that institutional knowledge. They know how the system works. They know how to game it. They know how to file reports in such a way that they avoid scrutiny and are still able to accomplish what they intended. And they knew that. They knew how to do that. They had the presence of mind to strategize that, even as they supported the erection of these campaign finance laws. Because it's not so that people they're justified. They're presented to you as a means to, as this guy here at the Campaign Legal Center says, as a means to cast light upon how campaigns work and how the political system operates so that the public can be knowledgeable of who's influencing their politics. The actual effect of campaign finance law is precisely the opposite. It's there to obscure. And in sinister fashion, it obscures under the guise of revelation. It keeps things secret by promising you to reveal the whole truth. That's why they were able to get away to this point with what they did. Let's go to the phone, 651-989-5855. Anthony in St. Paul, welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, as always, it's nice to talk to you. I appreciate you taking my call. It seems that this Trump-Russia dossier thing has really been hitting the airwaves. I mean, it was kind of obvious. The whole thing was fake from the beginning. And one thing I really want to note and emphasize is that this entire Russia investigation is, you know, it's occurring right now. And the Trump-Russia dossier was the entire basis for it, said by the CIA director, Brennan himself. Now, it's obvious, you know, we knew this from the beginning, but now it finally came out. The DNC paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of throw this out here. I think that the Republicans had something to do with it as well, because I don't think anybody wanted Trump in. None of these establishment people wanted Trump in. And even if we find out who did all this, what's really going to happen throughout the DOJ? And you know me, I'm hardcore Trump. I wholeheartedly believe Trump would do everything in his power to get these people prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But is it really going to happen?
You think it's going to get killed?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's more likely that Trump is going to get taken out before he actually gets anything. You know, before people go to prison that need to go to prison, and I'm extremely careful of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to delve into conspiracy theory, but the basic premise that there may be a glass house here, and the people who are in a position to investigate the Clintons and the DNC might find themselves inside that glass house and unwilling to throw stones. I think that's a fairly rational premise. You know, the idea that looking too closely at this specific manifestation of corruption has the potential to reveal other manifestations of corruption that would be damaging beyond the DNC and beyond the Clintons.
And one more thing I want to note, too, is it was leaked that there was a Republican.
Yeah.
That also helped with it.
Sure.
I'm just going to throw it out there. I think it was Jeb. It was either Jeb or Romney. That's all I'm going to say, because now that's all speculation.
Well, I appreciate you qualifying it as such, and appreciate you calling in, Anthony, as always. Let's go to Ann in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I'm calling because I wanted to know, too, exactly where is all our money that we pay into taxes going to? They've always said, well, you're getting a little piece of the pie here, and it's being paid there and there, but it's not proof enough to anybody exactly where this money's all going that we have to work hard for. And it's a really hard, serious situation, and it seems like the Democrats, as long as they're running the show, they're satisfied. And they're not, the way I see it, it doesn't look like they'll ever get back in there again to run this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's something, I appreciate your observation, Ann. There's something sinister about the concept of campaign finance law and the way it's presented as being a illumination of the inner workings of campaigns and political parties and what have you, because it doesn't actually have that effect. And by presenting the idea that it does have that effect, what it produces, I think intentionally, is complacency from the public, because people are able to submit to the fantasy that they know what's going on, that they know who's paying for what, that they know where something came from, that it's been properly sourced and vetted. They buy into that presented fantasy under the auspices of, well, we have laws on the books, right? And somebody must be enforcing them, and everything must be on the up and up. There's this kind of, there's probably some official term for it somewhere, but this kind of institutional trust, this sort of, you go back to like the 1950s and 1960s, early 1960s, this sort of unquestioning faith in the system. That's what campaign finance law facilitates. And under that guise, they are able to get away with all kinds of corruption, no doubt. You know, we're just getting a little peek behind the curtain with this dossier. And there's a story I didn't even get to here yet involving big bank money, big bank settlement money being funneled to liberal groups. We'll get into that when we come back. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So much stuff I planned to get to this hour that it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. We're down to like, what, I don't know, 8 minutes, 7 minutes. Still on this stuff regarding all the implications regarding the revelations, of which there are several at this point, regarding apparent corruption, apparent malfeasance, apparent cheating taking place by the Clinton campaign last year, the Democratic National Committee, the Obama administration. All depends on what the topic is. What, you know, everything from, let's see, colluding with the Russians in order to manufacture a fake news story about Trump colluding with the Russians. I mean, it's almost comical, isn't it? I mean, you could, if SNL had the wherewithal and they could be bipartisan for a second, there's a sketch in there in terms of fake news about creating fake news. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Another thing dropped recently. This from the Daily Caller. Emails written by Obama administration Department of Justice officials confirm reports the agency engaged in a systemic effort to funnel money to liberal advocacy organizations from settlements reached with big banks. The documents obtained by the House Judiciary Committee as part of an ongoing investigation reveal the Obama Justice Department effectively skirted Congress's budgetary authority by requiring that major financial institutions donate to a group of affordable housing nonprofits and legal advocacy organizations as part of settlement agreements resulting from predatory mortgage lending practices. The internal DOG documents represent the latest revelation in a two-year investigation spearheaded by House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte. The investigation has thus far yielded evidence implicating the Obama DOJ in using mandatory donations to funnel roughly $1 billion in settlement money to activist groups, including, get this list. It starts off with a zinger. The National Council of La Raza, which, in case you're not aware, like this is the probably this and in a couple other spare words here and there, the only Spanish I actually know. La Raza means the race. Now, just can we just pause for a second to imagine if you didn't know what, if there was no other context and you were presented with the name of an organization, and the name of that organization was the National Council of the Race. Where would your mind go to? Like, where would your thoughts randomly drift towards? Sounds like Nazis to me, right? The National Council of the Race, the race. What's the, like, the superior race? The only race? What are you talking about? So, yeah, that's one of the organizations that got money from the Obama DOG, or DOJ. Also on the list, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition and the National Urban League. The list of third-party organizations were unrelated to the legal settlements, except through general claims that they would use the funds to aid the low-income Americans most severely harmed by predatory lending practices. So, what you have here is the other side of the coin from the IRS discrimination against and harassment of conservative groups. Basically, as we get some distance between us and the Obama administration and Barack Obama's legacy starts to take clearer shape, what we see is that on the one hand, he was using the club of the state in order to harass and suppress his political opposition. And I'm not even talking about like institutionalized opposition, right? Like the Republican Party. I'm talking about people like you and me. People like the Rochester Tea Party Patriots, run by people who I know personally, normal folks, business owners, everyday people who tried for months and months, I don't know if they ever actually accomplished it, to get recognized by the IRS as a 501c3 and ran into artificial obstacle after artificial obstacle, which it was later revealed was intentional under the direction of Obama's IRS. So on the one hand, you had that. And now we learn, on the other hand, you had that same club of the state being used to bash banks over the head, seize their money through settlement, and then redistribute that money to left-wing liberal activist organizations. I was about to say unbelievable, but it's all too believable. It's all too believable. This is why, and you know, we're gonna get into next hour, you know, when I start to examine what Steve Bannon is doing politically now, and questioning its efficacy and whether or not he's gonna get anywhere with it. This is where it's in moments like this that I am able to understand best the Trump phenomenon. Because the level of disgust in response to a revelation like this is so powerful that you just want to see these people fail. You just want to see them fail. You want to see them lose. You want to see them punished. You want to see them embarrassed. You want to see justice served. And that is something that Trump provides a sense of. I don't know that he actually provides it, but he provides the sense of it. That they are losing, that they are on the way out, that the swamp is being drained, you know, however it is that you want to phrase it. A revelation like this it evokes a craving to see that happen. And so, you know, I hope that as this investigation moves forward, as new complaints are filed, as new investigations are made, that eventually we come to a point where there is some sense of actual justice that takes place here. But I will believe it when I see it. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. We'll be back momentarily. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I cringe when I see Republicans and I see conservatives adopting the language of the left. The left is able to move the cultural needle. You know, Glenn Beck wrote a book some years back called The Overton Window, which was actually pretty decent. And the premise of it is, you know, what the Overton Window refers to is the range of things that people are willing to accept. Like the range of concepts that people are generally willing to accept as legitimate. And what the left is very, very good at is moving that window, changing the culture to where what was completely unacceptable yesterday is suddenly right smack in the middle of the center today. And the window's constantly moving in their direction. And part of the mechanism of how that happens is changing how the language is used, changing the definition of words, and getting people to adopt the language that the left wants you to use. And one of the phrases that has tended to be adopted beyond the left by the mainstream culture is this notion of hate speech. Hate speech or hate crime. When it first started being used, hate speech, the term hate speech or the term hate crime, when it first came on the scene, people generally were appropriately skeptical of it. They asked questions like, what is that? What do you mean by hate? What makes speech hate speech? And why should we care? And particularly when it comes to crime, you know, I've always been particularly mystified by the idea of hate crime. Can somebody point me to love crime? Can somebody give me an example of crime that's motivated by something other than hate? Crime that's motivated by something other than a dismissal of the worth of another human being? Isn't hatred kind of implicit in the word crime? Do we really need to tack it on? Does it tell us anything extra, anything particularly important? I think not. And yet, over the years, this language has been adopted. You know, you hear Republicans, you hear conservatives adopting the terminology hate speech, hate crime. And, you know, usually it's trying to reflect it back at the left. For instance, you know, you get into Antifa. Antifa is a good example. Antifa's actions are being portrayed as hate crime. And there's even been demands to treat the actions of Antifa as hate crime, which I get. I understand that instinct. I understand the desire to try to claim some sort of legitimacy by getting the opposition's actions categorized in that way. But what it actually does is it legitimizes the language that the left wants you to adopt. It conveys the sense that there actually is something categorically different about hate crime than every other type of crime. And which, again, you need to explain to me what that difference is, what distinguishes those categories. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up on the podcast right there in your iHeartRadio app. Just do a search for Closing Argument, 651-989-5855. The number to join us this evening, Brad Omlin, taking your calls, producing the program. From the College Fix, a Christian student leader is demanding an apology after a poster distributed by Kent State University asked if stating, quote, "you need Jesus," unquote, could qualify as hate speech. The Public University's Center for Student Involvement created and circulated the poster on Twitter last week. It was designed to promote an event on free speech issues as part of Kent State's Kent Talks, which are intended to provide a safe place for discussions and transformational experiences for our student body and promote civil discourse. Silhouetted activists on the posters hold a range of placards with messages overlaid with the rhetorical question, free speech or hate speech? Alongside provocative expressions including, no more gays, women need to serve their men, and build a wall, the fourth placard bears a nonviolent basic expression of the Christian faith, you need Jesus. Jared Small, president of the Campus Ministry International Student Organization, told the College Fix that the poster was inappropriate. The university should apologize because it appears to be targeted toward one political and religious side, he wrote in an email. He wrote, quote, they could have included hate speech against President Trump or hate speech against Christians as examples. In my opinion, free speech protects hate speech to an extent. However, the university appears to show a bias against Christians and conservatives, unquote. So you see here that even as this student attempts to push back against people who are trying to categorize a basic statement of his faith, of the Christian faith, as hate speech, even as he pushes back, he adopts their language. He adopts as legitimate the concept of hate speech and talks about how free speech protects hate speech. Well, you know, not for long, because you've adopted the concept, right? But that's not the point that I want to hammer on here tonight. Continuing at the College Fix, Professor Amy Reynolds, the dean of Kent State's College of Communications and Information, moderated last week's Kent Talks panel discussion on free speech. She told the Fix in an email that she had no involvement in creating the poster for the event. The Center for Student Involvement created all the promotional materials. I'm not sure what the process is or was. Neither Eric Mansfield nor Emily Vincent, the executive director and director of Kent State Media Relations, responded to repeated Fix queries. Neither did Kristen Dolan nor Rick Daniels, assistant director and assistant dean for the Center of Student Involvement. Jacob Brown, president of the Catholic Student Association, implied the posters were likely to refer to the Hellfire preachers who visit campus twice or so each year. Now, this is where it starts to get interesting. He said, I think it constitutes hate speech, that being the Hellfire preaching? No. Should the university apologize? No, he told the Fix in an email. Nobody wants to be told you're going to hell, Brown said. As a leader of a religious student organization, I put my face in my palm every time I see this religious protest, which echoes the zealousness of Jesus in challenging the money changers in the temple, but also comes across as tasteless and without empathy. So you see that the conversation very quickly turns to, and again, this is a guy who, he's the president of the Catholic Student Association, right? Presumably on our side, presumably on the conservative side, certainly the Christian side in this case. And even he adopts not just the language, but the orientation that there is something inherent to the content of speech that ought to qualify it as legitimate or illegitimate.
Well, 2 weeks ago, and if you want to play along, let me know. But 2 weeks ago, the New York Times published an article that is a quiz on whether or not certain statements meet Facebook's hate speech guidelines. Would you like to play?
Absolutely. Let's go.
Okay. Well, if I ever run for public office, what I'm about to say will probably be used against me. But just know that this is a quiz from the internet, the New York Times. So Facebook defines hate speech as, one, an attack such as a degrading generalization or slur, and two, targeting a protected category of people, including one based on sex, race, ethnicity, religious affiliation, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, and a serious disability or disease. So, is this hate speech? Why do Indians always smell like curry? They stink.
I would say that probably qualifies under the Facebook guidelines.
So you say yes, and yeah. Facebook says yes. According to Facebook's training document claiming that specific groups of people stink is a degrading generalization. A Facebook spokeswoman said that this statement would be flagged as hate speech because it targets a specific nationality, which is a protected category. And you would consider this previous statement hate speech, personally?
According to the definition offered, yes.
Okay. 75% of people do consider that hate speech.
Okay.
Number two, poor black people should sit at the back of the bus. Would Facebook consider this hate speech?
I would think so, yes.
No. Facebook's training document lists any call for segregation as an unacceptable attack. Facebook's training document lists any call for segregation as an unacceptable attack. subsets of protected groups do not receive the same protection, according to the document. Well, race is a protected category. Social class is not. So attacks targeting poor black people would not seem to qualify as hate speech under those rules.
I'm starting to see the birth of a training document for the alt-right in terms of how to conduct themselves online to avoid getting censored by Facebook.
Okay, here's number three. White men are a-holes.
No, that's not going to qualify because they're not a protected group.
Yes, Facebook said. This statement targets a subset of two protected categories. White men encompasses race and sex.
Oh, so they are consistent.
With an attack in the form of cursing.
Interesting.
So Facebook's rules take a cue from constitutional doctrine, providing equal protection to all races, genders, and orientations.
I would not have expected that.
She said this policy can lead to incongruous results since not all groups are equally vulnerable in all contexts.
Mm.
So would you consider the previous statement hate speech?
Well, I mean, you've given me the answer to the question, but my answer would have been that no, based on the description of hate speech that they provided, it would not qualify.
And 52% say no. Which is interesting.
Yeah,
because that's
interesting.
I remember I took this quiz and that was like the only one where it was like, no, that's not hate speech.
Hmm.
Number four, keep trans men out of girls' bathrooms. Would Facebook consider that hate speech?
Probably not.
It depends. And it says, well, some people might find the statement offensive. Others might not view it as controversial. The statement targets a group based on two protected categories, gender identity and sex, but calls for exclusion of that group.
Mm-hmm.
But it would most likely be permitted because of containing debates around transgender issues.
But see, it's odd because how do you say you're excluding the group when by the virtue of the fact that they're men, they're already excluded inherently from the girls' bathroom. So how is this even controversial?
I don't know. But would you consider the previous statement hate speech?
No.
57% of people would consider that hate speech.
Of course they would.
5 out of 6. Female sports reporters need to be hit in the head with hockey pucks. Would you consider that hate speech? Or would Facebook consider that hate speech?
Probably, yes, because it's a call for action to engage in violence.
No. Well, gender is a protected category. Facebook's training document states that occupation is not. Although this is a call to violence, it would not seem to violate the company's rules for hate speech. That is because including occupation in the attack negates the protection granted based on gender.
Mm.
So would you consider the previous statement hate speech?
No.
79% of people would consider that a hate speech.
Wow.
And lastly, I'll never trust a Muslim immigrant. They're all thieves and robbers. Would Facebook consider that hate speech?
Of course they would. Absolutely.
No.
Really?
Well, Facebook usually considers dismissive attacks, including those targeting groups based on religious affiliation, as unacceptable. The company's training materials classify immigrants as a quasi-protected category. That means that they are not protected against some attacks, including dismissive attacks. This quasi-protected category was created in response to increased online discussion of the Syrian refugee crisis. The idea that this wouldn't be hate speech to me undermines why you are even bothering prohibiting speech, the Facebook spokeswoman said. So you would consider that hate speech?
I would think it would qualify, yes.
90% of people say that would qualify as hate speech.
Interesting.
So, I mean, I appreciate that Facebook has nuance.
Sure.
But it doesn't seem to be consistent. But I think that's the point.
Well, and that, yeah, that's exactly it, is that this is all in the eye of the beholder. It's all subjective. When you start talking about hate, when you start qualifying what's going to be considered hate speech or not, by virtue of the fact that there's disagreement, it indicates that this is a subjective judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put government in the position of making subjective judgments, it's a pretty decent clue that you've ventured off the rails in terms of what government is supposed to be doing. The fact that you can have a statement that explicitly calls for violence and yet it doesn't qualify as hate speech under your guidelines indicates to me that there's a fundamental disconnect with what it is that you claim to be trying to do. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So elaborating a little bit on this story from the College Fix coming out of Kent State regarding a poster that was produced by a student organization, the Center for Student Involvement, which depicted a number of supposed hate speech messages. You know, they had four messages that were included on this poster. One was "no more gays." Another was "women need to serve their man." A third was "build a wall." right? Those are all considered examples of hate speech. And then they had a fourth placard that was depicted on this poster, and that one said, "You need Jesus." So obviously the implication being that proselytizing as a Christian is apparently hate speech now. And so that resulted in a complaint or a call for apology from a Christian student leader. Now, here's the thing that I want to highlight about this. There is a certain logic here, right? Like, we shouldn't be surprised that this is the direction that all this hate speech stuff is going. Of course, Christian thought, Christian expression, Christian proselytizing is going to be regarded as hate speech. Of course it is. Because the whole point of hate speech, the whole point is to protect people from feeling bad about something that somebody else says. I mean, that's how you define it, right? Like, how do you define when you're looking at, you know, Brad just went down a list of what is Facebook considered to be hate speech or not, and different people are going to give different answers. Indeed, sometimes it was often split 50-50, 60-40, whatever the case may be. The process that you go through to determine in your own mind whether or not speech is hateful is based upon your own sensibilities. It's you applying your values and channeling your emotional reaction to the content of the speech to determine whether or not you consider it to be hateful. And that's how you come to the category of hate speech or not hate speech, right? Now, if that's your standard, if that's how we identify hate speech as something that offends people, I got news for you. And I'm saying this as a Christian, okay? There is nothing more offensive, nothing than the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel of Jesus Christ starts off with the accusation, the denouncement, the sentence that you are wretched. You are a wretched human being who deserves death. Not just death, but eternal torment in hell, right? You deserve to die and to go to hell and to be tormented forever. That's how the gospel starts, right? That's bullet point number one. There is nothing conceivable that is more offensive than that. And it's not just, by the way, it's not just Hitler who deserves this, right? It's you. It's you. It's your parents, your children. It's every human being that has ever lived on the face of the earth, save one. Save one. Jesus, right? This is Christianity. Christianity 101. That is extraordinarily offensive. And so if our criteria for hate speech is going to be speech which offends you, of course Christianity is going to fall in that category. And this is the direction things are going. And, you know, look, as a side note here, let me put on my Christian hat for a second, all right? Just indulge me here for a moment. One of the problems I have with the church in the United States of America, and I'm talking small c, Christian church, we don't have any sense of what it means to truly be persecuted. And as a result, our theology and our sense of Christian life is very easily and commonly perverted. Because we're not challenged, we're not tested, we're not placed in the fire that burns away the chaff, right? But it's coming. It's coming. You can see the progression happening where, and it started with a lot of this hate speech stuff. Eventually, we are going to get to the point where it is going to be, to, and it largely already is, right? Like the legalization of gay marriage, and, you know, it is currently not legal. It is not legal to say, I'm going to be a person who bakes cakes for weddings, but I'm not going to bake a cake for a gay marriage, right? Like, you legally cannot do that. So already it's illegal to practice your faith as a Christian, already today. That's only going to ratchet up.
Even the dialogue after the Las Vegas shooter, you saw on Facebook calling him a white Christian terrorist.
Right.
Just associating that he was white, a male, and Christian, oh, that makes him a terrorist.
Absolutely. And this is the direction things are going. And it's intentional. It's intentional. Once you establish the standard, you know, going back to the concept of the Overton window and changing the culture and changing the language and getting you to adopt the language and what have you, once you've established the idea in the mainstream culture that it's okay to apply your subjective judgments and to weigh being offended as somehow a moral claim to action, once you've accepted that, then you've opened the door, you've established the mechanism by which you get to persecute, you get to oppress, you get to subjugate, you get to enslave your opposition. All you have to do is conjure the constituency. All you have to do is gather your forces. And that's what the left knows how to do. It's what they are doing. And look, we're going to get into, you know, when we come back, I want to talk about what Steve Bannon's up to. And I didn't intend this when I was coming up with the show tonight, but this actually flows very naturally from what we're talking about here with hate speech and the kind of environment in which a political oppression is enabled and what is happening in a certain segment of the right, which Steve Bannon is the personification of. Steve Bannon's whole operation is to take what the left has done and has been doing and to flip it on its head and do it in reverse, to mirror it against them, to fight fire with proverbial fire. That's his goal. Now, the problem that I have with that, one of the many problems that I have with that, is that just like adopting the language, when you as conservatives and Republicans, we start adopting the term hate speech and hate crime, just as that has an effect upon the culture, which is in to some degree irreversible, certainly difficult to reverse, and moves the needle, moves that Overton window in the direction of where the left wants to go. The same thing happens, arguably even worse, when we start to adopt their tactics. Their tactics and their rationalizations and their moral confusion. And that's what Steve Bannon has done. We'll talk about it when we return. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. My time involved with the Tea Party was highly instructive. You know, it kind of was a university course. An unofficial university course in the way politics works, going from 101, from ground zero, from knowing absolutely nothing. And I mean absolutely nothing. And it wasn't just me. It was all of us. It was all of us who were involved. I remember we used to have these meetings. It was me and other local organizers of various Tea Party groups around the metro area. We would get together at various restaurants. And at the peak, it was like two or three times a week. Two or three times a week, we would get together to just talk about what was happening, what we would like to do about it, you know, ideas for events, ideas for activism, you know, trying what comes next. You know, what are we trying to accomplish here? How do we grow this? How do we make it bigger? And these meetings were completely unstructured, had no agenda. Had no organization to them whatsoever at first. And it wasn't, it was because we didn't know how, right? Like there was nobody in the room who was versed in Robert's Rules of Order. There was nobody in the room who had any sense of how to organize something politically. And there was kind of a beauty to that. There was a beauty to that, an innocence. However, as time goes on, you learn how things do work and you adjust your strategy accordingly, if you want to actually be effective. And the story of the Tea Party, its rise, its effect, its victories, and ultimately what I consider to be its fall. And I think it's pretty well beyond dispute that it has fallen. That story is, I believe, a model. It's not something that, it's not the first time that a movement has risen and had some victories and fallen, and it's not the last. We're seeing it now. We're seeing history repeat itself under different ideas and different champions, but a similar thing is taking place under the banner of Trumpism. And I want to explore that here with news regarding what Steve Bannon is up to. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omlin taking those calls and eagerly getting you on the program. From the Star Tribune. Steve Bannon's war on the GOP establishment has caught the party's most powerful donors in the crossfire. Deep-pocketed supporters of Trump's agenda are divided over how best to spend their dollars to advance the Trump agenda. Once a whispered concern, the division was out front this week as donors who support President Donald Trump huddled deep in the Texas desert to discuss their strategy. It's not that they all oppose the president's former advisor's more radical version of conservatism, though some of them do. Like him, Bannon, they're frustrated and angry that the current Republican majorities in Congress have so far failed to rid the nation of Obamacare, overhaul the U.S. tax system, build a border wall, and more. But they fear he'll depose incumbent Republicans in favor of weaker challengers who will then lose to Democrats. Boy, this you could take out the specific references and the specific names and put this back in 2010, 2011, 2012. And this could be an article written about the Tea Party. Absolutely. Because this was the concern, right? That the Tea Party is going to end up, going to primary everybody ad nauseum and end up with a weaker party as a result. And we're ultimately going to end up losing. Continuing at the Star Tribune, Doug Deason, one of the big donors who attended the private gathering of America's First Action, the only Trump-sanctioned super PAC, said that Bannon is wasting time, energy, and resources by launching his aggressive campaign to take down Republican lawmakers that he feels stand in Trump's way. I really like Steve. I think he's a smart guy. He has good intentions. I just think it's kind of like the way he put it is pissing in the wind, Deason said. If Steve called and asked for support, I'd say no, but let's keep in touch. Tens of millions of dollars are at stake. Already America First is and its allied nonprofit have raised roughly $25 million with another $15 million in soft commitments from donors, according to one official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal discussions. Two dozen donors affiliated with America First spent Tuesday at the Mesa Vista, Texas ranch of billionaire oil man T. Boone Pickens. Many arrived via private jets on the landing strip on the property. These are the anti-establishment folks, by the way, landing in their private jets. The president's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., addressed the group, which is also affiliated with Trump loyalist Corey Lewandowski, Katrina Pearson, and former Wisconsin Sheriff David Clark. Bannon, who left his job as the president's chief strategist in August, was not invited. He maintains relationships with some America First officials, but he has been focused instead on assembling his own coalition of donors in recent weeks to promote what he recently called a season of war on the GOP establishment. I think that we are all allies at the end of the day. We all want to see pro-Trump, pro-America First candidates get elected, America First spokeswoman Erin Montgomery said. That doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything. She added, we really want to be the super PAC that supports the president the best way we can. Bannon's team, however, sees itself less bound to Trump and within its rights to apply political pressure to any and all Republicans. In fact, this is the key paragraph. In fact, Bannon has said he plans to seek Republican challengers for virtually every Republican senator seeking re-election next year, chiefly for the purpose of electing candidates who would remove Mitch McConnell of Kentucky from the post of Senate Majority Leader. We have seen this movie before, and it was called The Tea Party. I was part of it. I can tell you authoritatively. And look, you know, you don't need to have been a part of it to recognize this pattern. What Bannon is subscribing to here is a model of activism called confrontational politics. And what confrontational politics is, and this is as opposed to the more what you might consider the establishment way of doing things, which is access-based politics. Access-based, that's your lobbyist, right? That's your lobbyist, that's your donor network, that's your steering committee, that's, you know, getting access to the candidates, access to the quarters of power, FaceTime with your congressman or your congresswoman or your senator or whatever the case may be, in order to influence them with access. Confrontational politics, it takes a different course. And that's the idea that you are going to do what we want, not because, you know, we gave contributions or because, you know, we're your constituents that support you, you know, politically and organize for you, whatever the case may be. But you're going to support us under the threat that if you don't, we're going to primary you. Now, this model works, and it works very well in very specific circumstances. For instance, you know, as a Democrat, there's no way that you can successfully run. It'd be very difficult to successfully run for a endorsement or a nomination as a Democrat on a pro-life platform. Like, if you come out and you say you're against abortion, you're going to have a really hard time running as a Democrat because the confrontational politics employed by pro-choice groups within the Democratic apparatus is very effective. Similarly, on the right, in the Republican Party, if you try to run as a pro-choice candidate within the Republican Party, you are going to have a problem. You are going to be facing headwinds because the pro-life groups are very effectively organized within the Republican Party. Now, the reason for that is because people feel very passionately about that issue, and they are easily activated by that issue, and they are willing to vote on that issue alone. And so these groups are very effective within their respective parties at policing candidacies and fielding primary opponents and what have you in order to affect their cause. What you see too often, and I have run into with people that I know personally here in this state, is an attempt to adopt the confrontational model, the confrontational style, in a broader sense, where you basically say, you're not liberty enough, right? You're not liberty enough, so we're going to run somebody against you. Now, the problem with that is, what do you mean by liberty? What do you mean by you're not liberty enough? And how do you activate? Where's the constituency that you can activate to actually make good on your threat that you're going to primary somebody because they're, quote, not liberty enough, right? It's much more difficult. It's not as easy as organizing around a specific issue like guns or abortion or taxes or whatever. Specific issues, it's very effective to engage in confrontational politics. But to try to say, you're generally just not good enough for us, is not a very effective position from which to try to launch this type of campaign. And that's what Steve Bannon is doing. Steve Bannon is basically saying, you're either going to get on board with making America great again, or we're going to primary you, and he's setting his sights on literally everybody. That is not going to be effective. It's not. And so, you know, I hope you've enjoyed this success while it's lasted, because if we continue to see Bannon and folks who agree with him adopt these tactics, we've seen it before, we know where it ends, and it's not with success. You know, remember, the Tea Party, you know, the idea that the Tea Party was going to be anything but the future in 2010 was unthinkable. Well, where is it now? Same thing can happen again and will. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. All right, so let's get into this story that we had the promo talk about today, which was the Eau Claire City Council. This caught my eye last night, and I had to shoehorn it into the program tonight. From the Star Tribune, the Eau Claire, Wisconsin City Council voted Tuesday to ban children from the council dais during meetings after one of its members said she had a legal right to breastfeed her child during council sessions. The council voted 7-1 after a highly charged debate. Three members, including counselor and mother Catherine Emmanuel, abstained from the vote in protest. Well, that's interesting. What I really want to say is I refuse, said Emmanuel in explaining her abstention. She had proposed that children be allowed to sit with their elected parents as long as they weren't a distraction, but she was voted down. The vote follows months of tension after Emmanuel first brought her now 11-month-old son to a council meeting. Emmanuel said she was told by Kerry Kincaid, council president, that four council members had complained about her breastfeeding. In a compromise, Emmanuel agreed to sit in an area reserved for the public when she had her son with her. Speaking about the experience during Tuesday's council meeting, Emmanuel said it took several months and a consultation with an attorney before she had the courage to say earlier in October that she planned to stay in her chair during meetings, even if she had her son along. She said it had been impossible to fully participate in the council meetings when she sat in the public area. Yeah, I imagine that's probably the case. Kincaid couldn't be reached Tuesday for comment. So, the interesting thing here is I can relate on one level, and that is I, too, am a city council member. And also, I, too, have, on occasion, brought my children to meetings. Now, there hasn't been any breastfeeding involved, but there has been the potential for, and perhaps a little bit of actualized distraction. Something that I've been very aware of on the occasions where I've had to bring my kids with, either bring them with or not show up to the meeting, right? Sometimes circumstances like that turn up. And, you know, it's always been top of my mind on those occasions where I've had to bring my kids with me to a city meeting that it's my obligation to ensure that they're not a distraction. And as they've gotten older, that's become easier, you know. But your 11-month-old, who is apparently under need of immediate feeding, probably not as easy to pass that on. So there's that aspect of it that, you know, just being considerate, being professional in this position where you volunteered to serve, to represent the people. And then the other aspect of it is this idea of having a right to do it. Like, this is pretty nonsensical, and it comes from the same notion that people, the misconception that people get, that you have a right to show up to a public meeting and spout off about whatever you want, whenever you want, for however long you want. No, you don't. No, you don't. But it's a public meeting. Yeah, let me tell you what that actually means. And in order to provide the framework for understanding it, and in what context, you tell me, in what other context does the preface public imply that you get to do whatever you want? For instance, a public library, right? It's public. Does that mean you can go there at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's closed? Does that mean you can show up and just randomly decide you're gonna have, you and your band are gonna get together and practice in the middle of the floor between the stacks? No. There are rules. There are rules regarding when it's open, when it's closed. There are rules of conduct, what you can do and on what terms. And these rules are established by public policy. Somewhere along the line, somebody empowered to make the decision as to what the rules are going to be comes down with a decree, and then you are obligated as a member of the public to follow suit. The same is true regardless of which side of the dais you're on at a city council meeting. At any governmental meeting, there are rules which govern the conduct of both the people who've been elected and the people who are there to address those who have been elected. And those rules are established for a reason. And there's nothing illegitimate whatsoever about saying, listen, in order to facilitate the people's business, you don't get to breastfeed your kid right now. Okay? You're going to need to come up with an alternative arrangement. That's entirely fair. From Fox News, a math education professor at the University of Illinois says the ability to solve geometry and algebra problems and teaching such subjects perpetuates so-called white privilege. Yes, that's right, folks. Math is racist. Rochelle Gutierrez laid out her views on the subject in an article for a newly published anthology for math educators titled Building Support for Scholarly Practices in Mathematics Methods. School mathematics curricula emphasizing terms like Pythagorean theorem and pi, P-I, perpetuate a perception that mathematics was largely developed by Greeks and other Europeans, she says, according to Campus Reform. She also says that addressing equity in mathematics education will come when teachers can understand and negotiate the politics outside the classroom. On many levels, mathematics itself operates as whiteness, she says. Who gets credit for doing and developing mathematics, who is capable in mathematics, and who is seen as part of the mathematical community is generally viewed as white, she writes. Further, she says mathematics operates with unearned privilege in society, just like whiteness. You know, my first instinct, probably not unlike yours, is to rage against this particular machine that she's cranking on here. The absurdity of claiming that mathematics is somehow racist. But listen, that goes without saying, right? It goes without saying that it's absurd to accuse math of being racist. I think the more interesting thing here to do is engage in a kind of jujitsu, kind of take her momentum and turn it against her. The obvious absurdity of calling math racist and then tying that in with the general concept of white privilege goes to show how ridiculous the left's concept of white privilege is. Right? That it's not just, there's a certain, you know, one of the left's favorite tactics is to conflate things, to take something that's true and take something that's false and combine them together and talk about them as if they're the same thing. And there are certain truths that are referenced in conversations about white privilege that are legitimate, right? Like the idea that you get a regard that generally speaking, people tend to relate to those who are like them more than they relate to those who are not. Like, that's just generally true about human beings. And it's true, you know, whether you're a white person in Minnesota or you're a black person in Niger, right? Or in Ethiopia. Like, wherever you happen to be, the majority culture is going to regard their own in a different way than they regard people who deviate from that majority, from that norm. You know, that's just normal. And so when we cite that as when something like that is referenced as white privilege, that's a legitimate observation. But then you tie it into this idea that there's somehow something wrong with that. There's somehow something oppressive about that. And, you know, the absurdity of it is demonstrated by the fact that we now have to regard math itself as somehow being racist. The Pythagorean theorem, the concept of pi, is racist because it was developed by Greeks and Europeans. Listen, these are called facts, right? Like, factually, historically, that's where it came from. You know, this actually, by perpetuating this, she's feeding into the alt-right. She's feeding into the ideas which inform the ethnocentric notions of the alt-right, which claims that there's something inherent to race that ought to be preserved in Western culture. She's perpetuating racism through these statements. She is her own worst enemy. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, twincitiesnewstalk.com.